Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest today is Shelley Banjo, the TikTok expert. She is the New York bureau chief at Bloomberg and also host of the Foundering podcast. Shelley, good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, how long have you been following TikTok?
So I've been following TikTok about 3-4 years now.
And what inspired you to start?
So I was living in Hong Kong at the time and covering tech. And I had flown back over to the U.S. and my U.S. tech editor said to me, what's the biggest story that everybody is missing in Asia? And I said, the rise of TikTok, hands down, we need to be writing more about TikTok and its parent company, ByteDance.
Okay. So at the time, it was still Musical.ly in America. It hadn't been purchased yet.
It had been. It had already been purchased, yeah.
Let's just assume, you know, a lot of people need to be brought up to speed here. So when was Musical.ly purchased by TikTok?
So it was purchased in the end of 2017, but it didn't actually switch over to TikTok in the U.S. until really 2018.
Okay. So you say this to your editor in New York. What's the next step?
So the next step is, you know, we start digging into this company, ByteDance. I mean, Musical.ly had been a big hit. This was right after ByteDance had acquired Musical.ly. They had spent $1 billion basically trying to buy this app that most people thought of as just this like nothing karaoke kids app. And when suddenly they spent $1 billion on it, people started saying, okay, maybe there's something to this that we should be paying attention to.
Okay, so you start digging into ByteDance. What do you find?
I started working on this Business Week newspaper, news magazine story to kind of tell the story of this company, like who are they? And so what I started realizing was that even though a lot of people in China knew what ByteDance was, people in the U.S. didn't really realize it was this kind of sleeping giant that was starting to buy up a whole bunch of U.S. tech startups. They didn't quite understand what they were doing. And meanwhile, this company was getting just bigger and bigger and bigger in China, getting amassing more money and then using it to buy up companies in the U.S.
Okay. We're pretty ethnocentric in the U.S. What is the landscape of these internet companies in China? You know, we hear about WeChat, we hear about ByteDance. You know, how many of these companies are there and what's the barrier to entry?
It is ruthless. I mean, you think about business being tough here in the U.S. In China, it is just like people are going at each other left and right. There is no kind of decorum there, like, oh, I'll be in this, you know, area of the internet and you be in that area of the internet. You know, like we used to have in the US with like Google and Amazon and Apple kind of staking their ways. And in China, it's all like super apps, right? So like all these companies, like the biggest ones, like Tencent, ByteDance, Alibaba, they're into everything. They're into literally you wake up in the morning, you can buy your breakfast on it, you buy your Starbucks on it, you chat with your friends, you buy airplane tickets. It's you know, everything on these kind of super apps. So at the time, it was really these two big companies, Alibaba and Tencent. And all of a sudden came along this third company, ByteDance, which is the owner of TikTok, first starting with jokes, an app about jokes, then getting into news. Suddenly they were the biggest news reader in the entire world, meaning like nobody got their news anyplace else except for this one app. Then they went into short video. Now they're in e-commerce, in payments, you name it, education, you name it, they're in it now.
Okay. You know, Nixon opened up China back in the 70s, and then we had the former guy, as they say, who has had a trade war with China. And it's like a lot of citizens have not traveled at all, you know, U.S. citizens, never mind going to China. So my question is, since you were there, and I assume you also went to mainland China, correct?
Yeah.
For the average person, what is life like? On one hand, we hear about these people working, you know, 6 days a week all day in factories that we think are sweatshops. On another level, we see people buying Teslas. I mean, what is the socioeconomic status there?
It is so big that it is really hard to make one monolithic case for it. You know, if you're in if you're in Shanghai or Beijing, you know, working in an office tower, you kind of feel like anywhere else, New York or London or something like that. If you're in the countryside, it feels very different. But one very big unifying factor is an app like TikTok, which in China, it's called Douyin. And whether you're rich, you're poor, you're young, you're old, you are using the Chinese version of TikTok to make videos, to pass the time, to, you know, have a laugh with your friends. It certainly is something that, like, cut across all different, spheres, socioeconomic, you name it.
Okay. So if you're one of those people living in the city, these apps are multifarious much more than in the United States. Would you say that they are actually technically more advanced than we are, dependent on the internet, more, less, the same?
So I think that people in China are just more on the internet. I mean, we think about how the phone is kind of an extension of our arms. You know, we kind of joke about that. But, you know, a lot of people still buy things online, buy things in stores, go grocery shopping in stores. In the big cities in China, it's like unheard of to go into a store to buy your groceries or to buy clothes or to buy anything, really. Everything is e-commerce, and so much more of your life is on the internet. In terms of the advancement, I think at the time that ByteDance and TikTok were starting out, the artificial intelligence for those particular apps were probably more advanced than what we're seeing now. But they also took a different tack to social media. So, like, the Facebooks and Twitters and YouTubes of the world were, you know, the Facebooks and Twitters and Snapchats of the world were basically created around your friends. Like, this idea of, okay, I care about this thing because my friend cares about this thing, so I'm going to show you that thing. But ByteDance, because of the influence of the Chinese government, really, like, they don't want you to have those kinds of social media networks. They don't want you to build these networks of communities and things like that because they don't want you to, you know, rebel against the government or have a place to talk about it. So it was mostly built around yourself, the individual. What can I show to you that will keep you addicted on this app based on what you like? And then that change, as you change, it changes. So you're seeing something different than your friend is seeing, than your mom is seeing, than your dad is seeing, because that app is so personalized to you. So we've seen a lot of that with YouTube, but this almost takes it to, like, a complete, you know, other level there.
Just a couple of back China questions before we go. Now, we read about being able to pay for things with your phone. Is it very technically advanced like that in the cities?
Yeah, everything. You can't. I remember one of the first takeaways when I traveled. I would spend about a week of every month in Shanghai or Beijing or Shenzhen, and you can't use cash anywhere. Nobody takes cash. You try to give a taxi driver a bill, and they look at you like you have two heads. Like, why are you handing me this dirty piece of cash? Like, pay with your phone. That's how I'm going to take payment.
That begs the question, what is the crime like in the big cities?
Petty crime is fairly low. I mean, they are very, it kind of depends where you are. The real big crime is, like, you know, white collar crime and things like that can definitely still happen. Corruption, things like that.
Okay, so it's a vast country territorially and, as you said, economically. To what degree do people rely on wireless as their primary internet connection? What I mean by that is their only internet connection, or is the country pretty wired out hardwire?
So in the big cities, it's all wireless. Like, there are lots of people, kids that you talk to, who've never had a desktop computer. They don't really understand what that is. You know, it's all about this mobile phone in your hand and in your pocket, because it became so cheap that everybody basically has a mobile phone. And then even in the countryside and things like that, like, everybody has a phone.
And is coverage pretty much universal, or can you go somewhere where you have a dead spot?
Definitely can go somewhere where you have a dead spot. But, you know, I remember hiking in the mountains outside this town, outside the city called Guilin. And these, you know, you're in these rice paddies and you see these farmers literally getting rice, but you have this perfect cell signal and you can post on it, you know, on online and things like that.
Okay, just to go deeper into a point you made, if, you know, in certainly, I don't want to get too far ahead, but we talk about the algorithms in sharing. Let's just use the YouTube as a model. So let's assume I create a video. To what degree can that go viral in China? And to what degree can I garner fame as a result?
Yeah, so the algorithms around TikTok and Douyin in China are still a black box as they are in other, you know, with other places. But some of the differences is that I can just get such a bigger audience because it doesn't rely, what you're seeing in the videos that you're seeing doesn't rely on how many friends or connections or likes that you have. You see videos based on anyone, and it could be anyone from around the world. So you have not only like a global atmosphere, but it's also not tied to your friends. And because so much of it is tied to music, language isn't as much of a barrier. So if you think about when you post on Twitter, someone, someone in Africa or someone in the Middle East might not necessarily want to read about your English posts and things like that. But when you think about a music video, it's universal.
So you can gain fame. You just can't connect with other people and create a social network.
I mean, you can definitely still connect. You can add connections and things like that, but that's not necessarily why you're being showed the videos that you're seeing.
Okay. So a company like ByteDance, where does it get its financing?
So with ByteDance, what they were really smart about was very early on, they got a lot of Western venture capital money. Raised money from all sorts of big venture capital firms in the West, like Sequoia, General Atlantic. They also got money from SoftBank in Japan. Also got Chinese money as well, but they have a really big global base of investors, and they raised a lot of money, making them the most valuable private tech company right now.
They're more valuable than Alibaba and Tencent?
Well, those are public, Alibaba and Tencent.
Oh, I see. So you're talking about a private company. Just to get into the law, don't they have laws in China that Western people can only own a certain percentage of the company?
So with a private venture capital firm, there's not really necessarily the same kind of laws around those things. Right now they're talking about, doing an IPO, maybe going public, taking parts of their company public, and there are, more strict laws around that.
Who's the driving force of ByteDance?
The CEO of ByteDance is this guy named Zhang Yiming. He grew up in a part of China that, really opened up to the world of business much earlier than the rest of China. His parents were both civil servants, but he got into tech. He was a big self-described tech nerd during college. He helped fix computers, and that's kind of, he tells the story of how he met his wife by offering to fix her computer. And he worked at a number of startups over the years and then decided he was going to start his own. And that's what turned into ByteDance.
And how old a guy is he today?
He's in his late 30s. And he's, at the time, I think he was 32 when he started his company. So he definitely was not the 18-year-old, Mark Zuckerberg in a dorm room story. He had been around the block. He had worked at a number of successful tech companies, and he even worked at Microsoft for a brief amount of time.
So when the company started, ByteDance started when?
ByteDance started in 2012.
Okay. What was their aegis? What was their purview starting in 2012? What did they start with?
ByteDance started with a jokes app called Neihan Duanze. And basically what that is it was very simple. They showed you these jokes or memes. And if you liked it, you'd give it a thumbs up. And if you didn't like it, you'd give it a thumbs down. And over time, the more it got to know you, how long you kind of hovered on that joke, which ones you liked, which ones you didn't, it kind of got to know really your sense of humor. And they were able to kind of learn. That was kind of like their learning app of how they did that. But where they really made their mark was a company called Toutiao, which is a newsreader. And they used the same exact thing that they learned about with the Jokes app to tailor news to you. So if you think about the newspapers in the U.S., you know, you've got real people, editors who are choosing what they think is important based on news judgment. And, you know, it's this kind of, you know, meat and potatoes approach where they're giving you things you want to know, but also the things you need to know. Toutiao, the newsreader app, was never had human editors in the early days. It was all based on, you know, what people were reading and what they liked and getting to know their personalities. And they would learn kind of what you liked and offer you up that kind of news, which was so unique in China, because most of the news that you get in China is government-owned publications.
Okay, so when did they veer into the music sphere?
So the first kind of entrance into music in the U.S. was with this company called Flipagram, which I don't know if you ever remembered, but it was...
This is a ByteDance company?
No, it was a company that they bought in the U.S.
Okay, so they had no presence in music till they bought Flipagram.
Oh, well, they had launched the TikTok version, Douyin, in China before they launched it globally. And so that would be their first foray into music.
Okay, so in China, so what year was that?
They launched Douyin, I think, in 2017.
Okay. Were other people in that space in China? Who was the big kahuna in that space?
Yeah, so a similar company called Kuaishou. It was a startup that was backed by Tencent, which is, you know, a big music plays very big in music, but they weren't really known for music, right? It was a lot of video. It was not as much as music.
Okay, so why does ByteDance buy Flipagram?
So early on, they were kind of just stealing the music for these things. They were ripping off these 15-second iTunes previews off the internet. And just because they were so short and because they were such a small company, nobody was really paying attention to what they were doing. And at a certain point, their Western backers, Sequoia, GA, others, said to them, you know, if you're going to grow bigger, you're going to have to do this legally. And music, as you know, has had a long battle of legal rights and IP and things like that. So what Flipagram had was a lot of these contracts with music companies. They had already negotiated a bunch of contracts with different labels. And that was one of the largest reasons why they bought it. And just... a reminder, because it was a small app at the time. Flipagram was this kind of slideshow app. It would kind of let you make these slideshows really, really quickly and allow you to then share them over Twitter or Facebook or things like that with music put to it. And so Flipagram had done it the right way. They had, you know, negotiated with all these record labels and whatnot. And ByteDance just bought them and then shut down the app and inherited all the music label agreements.
So why did ByteDance buy Musical.ly?
So at the time, they wanted to become a global company. And so they were saying, okay, well, we want to launch TikTok globally, which they did. It didn't really take off in the U.S. at the time. And Musical.ly, they saw, was just, you know, growing like gangbusters, top of the Apple Music charts. And they knew that there was a lot of interest in it. From, you know, Facebook considered buying them, other companies had discussions with them. And then they found out that Kuaishou, their Chinese competitor, was also in talks to buy Musical.ly. And that really got them going because they were like, well, I'm not going to let my biggest competitor in and buy this and get these inroads and all of a sudden get, you know, 100 million, 200 million U.S. users just like that. And so they decided, okay, we're going to buy Musical.ly. We're going to also inherit those contracts with music labels, which they had started to get at the time. and automatically get, you know, a user base of 100, 200 million people, depending on how you count it, in the U.S., which they didn't have before.
Okay, so they had TikTok before they bought Musical.ly. Were they essentially equivalent platforms in the way they operated?
It was a little different because Musical.ly was really focused on karaoke and lip syncing and, you know, dancing and singing. TikTok was a big, that was a big portion of it, but not all of it. They also wanted to build it out to all sorts of things like comedy and pranks and, you know, cooking. There's, you know, hacks, life hacks, all sorts of different ways you could do it. So that would be the one big difference between the two.
Okay. So when did Musical.ly launch? When did they start?
So Musical.ly started around 2014. What people didn't really know was that Musical.ly was also a Chinese company. People seem to kind of forget that it was started in by two guys that had half the operation in Shanghai. They had a number of people in LA. And they started because they wanted to be an education app at first and then realized, okay, kids don't want to learn online. They want to have fun. And so they totally pivoted and in 30 days built a completely new app all around singing and dancing and things like that. And quickly realized that, you know, people in China were not jumping onto this, but people in the US were loving it. And so these like small towns and, you know, Texas, for example, was one really early place where like this high school in Texas was loving Musical.ly. And they started realizing like, wow, we have a knack. We've hit it with American kids. And they just kept focusing more and more on the U.S. and getting bigger here.
So tell us about the founder of Musical.ly and when he started.
Yeah. So Alex Ju is the way to hear people talk about Alex Ju to me is one of the more interesting things of this podcast, because people describe him as, you know, like a poet or a dreamer or, you know, just this kind of totally the opposite of what you think about in like a Silicon Valley tech, you know, bro culture type of thing. You know, he had this vision of connecting people around the world with music and really cultivating the users. So, you know, at the time, it's funny to think back on it, you know, but, you know, a decade ago, Twitter, Facebook, others, they all saw themselves as a tech platform. But Musical.ly, they were like, no, we really want to focus on these creators, these stars. You know, they were building that from the beginning. And so, you know, we hear these stories about him, about Alex talking about, you know, taking out these creators to dinner, calling their parents at home, you know, just making fake accounts. In the Foundering podcast, we hear him talking about how he would make these fake accounts just to like interact with some of these kids who were like 8, 9 years old. And here you have this 36-year-old Chinese guy basically like chatting with 8-year-old kids to like really get into their minds and kind of like figure out, you know, like what do they want? What do they like? That kind of thing.
Okay. And ultimately, they merged the two. You say in the podcast that that Musical.ly's algorithm was superior to TikTok's. Is that true?
The other way around. So TikTok infused into Musical.ly was the algorithm. So what Musical.ly was great at that was this whole idea of really getting the zeitgeist of what kids want and what's popular and kind of getting them to download the app. And what TikTok brought with them was this algorithm that would get them addicted, that would get them, you know, get them really obsessive with the app and checking it and on it for hours and hours, because it started to really get to know who you were, what you liked, and continue to offer that up and kind of get you hooked onto this app.
Okay, let's jump all the way forward to today. What do we know? Unlike yourself, most of the media is run by older people who don't understand this, who are doing their jobs, not spending hours on the internet and the nooks and crannies, and they tend to miss what is really going on. To use some cliches, Facebook is for old people. Okay. Instagram, certainly young people went there. They had private accounts. Snapchat has not really grown out of the younger demo. And there are these battles between, now we even have Clubhouse in this. Where does TikTok sit in the landscape?
So I think before the pandemic, the landscape that TikTok fit into was really this younger Gen Z demographic. You know, these kids were too young. You know, they don't get Facebook. They have Instagram, but it was like too much for them. They wanted a place where they could kind of be more themselves. Gen Z is a lot more, you know, you talk to any 15-year-old and you hear the word authentic in like the first 10 minutes of them talking. And you're like, what the heck does that mean? You know, and at least it was this idea that they could be themselves and have fun on this app without having this picture perfect manicured Instagram post. So I think that's where they fit in. But during the pandemic, you know, everybody was shut in their homes with literally nothing to do. And people said, okay, well, I'll download this thing, TikTok, that everyone keeps talking about. And then you started really seeing the proliferation of like moms on TikTok or cooking on TikTok, you know, things that more adults, you know, wanted to take part in. And so once they have you, I mean, the hardest thing, the hardest battle for TikTok is getting you to download it. Once they have you, they can figure you out in a number of days and start to show you videos that you want to see. So the more adults there were on there, the more kind of grown-up content there is. And the difference between Facebook and TikTok is when all the old people showed up on Facebook, the young people left because they didn't want their parents to see them or they didn't want to see their parents. But with TikTok, you never see your parents because they don't show you those videos and vice versa. And that's why it's hard for adults to keep track of what their kids are doing because they never see what their kids see.
Okay. Certainly at this point in time, most Americans are aware of the power of Zuckerberg and Facebook and WhatsApp and Instagram. But historically, like with the Microsoft lawsuit 20 years ago, the government and the public at large are behind. Can TikTok usurp the power of Facebook, or do they have to exist side by side?
I don't think they can necessarily usurp all of the power of Facebook, but they can certainly give Facebook a run for its money. And that's what you're seeing. I mean, reporting for Foundering for the podcast, we just kept running into Zuckerberg over and over and over again. You'd realize that, like, you know, Facebook cared about TikTok. They were paying attention about TikTok. They're worried about TikTok. They tried to imitate TikTok and have not really successfully done that. And so I think it is definitely giving them a run for their money. And from an advertising perspective, which is really important to Facebook's future growth, all the advertisers are on TikTok now. And a lot of money is going there. And so right now, I think they can kind of coexist. But at a certain point, as TikTok gets bigger and more sophisticated, some of that money is going to just flat out go away from Facebook and over to TikTok.
Okay. Let's assume someone's a complete newbie. You download the app. What happens next?
So you download the app and all of a sudden your full screen is taken up by a video. It's probably the first video you see is going to be somebody dancing and singing. And probably your first reaction is like, okay, this isn't really for me. And then you're going to scroll up on the screen as if you were scrolling through Instagram. And you're going to see another video, probably not for you. And then you'll see that third video and be like, oh, that's interesting. And you're going to linger on that video for a few minutes. And then like, boom, that's the first data point that company knows. Okay, you don't like those two videos. You like this video because you've lingered on it for more than a half second. They'll know where you might be touching it. Sometimes they'll be able to also analyze all of your data points that come with it. Where do you live? What location are you at? Who are you friends with? What age are you? What's your demographic? They'll match all of that information about you behind the scenes to the types of videos that you like. And in about a week, you're going to be seeing all the videos that you really want to see. And then in about 2-3 weeks, you'll probably be spending an hour or two on the app. Like if you really end up liking it at a time, because it just gets to know you.
Okay. Once again, for those who think they don't need it, what kind of content might you see on TikTok?
So you'll see whatever your like psyche wants to see, which sounds a little bit crazy, but it's like, it's the things you don't even necessarily know you like that you might end up seeing. So let's say you're really into cooking. I have an editor who loves cooking and he is just obsessed with it and he's starting to see a lot of it. Around the elections, I was doing a lot of digging into what kids and others were seeing around the U.S. elections, what kind of Trump content, Biden content that there was out there. So you can kind of train the app. If you're looking for something in particular, people talking about politics, there's a lot of dancing. There's a ton of music. There's a ton of different, you know, communities. For a time, there was a military TikTok. There's fitness TikTok. There's eating TikTok. There's kind of any little corner of the internet that you want to find. You can find it on TikTok.
Okay. Would I literally join that or the algorithm would just get me to see videos of that?
So you can search. There is a tab on there, a discover section, that's kind of like the discover section at Instagram, where if you want to search for some of those things, you can. And there are, you know, they do push content out to you. So you'll see some of that content. If you want to. But a lot of the kids you talk to, they're like, do you ever look at that discover section? And they're like, no, I just kind of see what's shown to me, which is called the For You page. But there is a discover section. You can search if you're looking for something in particular. But most people just kind of look through whatever pops up for them.
What percentage of the videos are music?
Most videos, I don't have a number off the top of my head, but I would say 90%, like even if it's a cooking video, you'll put it to music and they'll use like text on the video to kind of show you what you're doing. Like a 10-step video of how to make guacamole, there'll be like a track. And there's a whole library, like it's called the Sound Library. You can save clips that you like. And, you know, for the Foundering podcast, we went really deep into this whole idea of the sounds library, because what TikTok can do is they can see, okay, who's saving this song or this clip of this song? And they can see kind of the velocity of that. And so they'll be able to tell you what song is about to go viral, you know, a week from now, because they can tell who's saving this song to make these videos with it later.
Okay, why would someone be on TikTok as opposed to watching Reels or something else on a different platform? What is the raw addiction that makes TikTok superior?
Well, Reels came later, so I think it's still kind of dealing with some of that, copycat stuff. Before there was Reels, there wasn't really a place to go. It is Reels basically copied TikTok. It's pretty similar. The difference is that what TikTok is able to do is give you a whole host of different video editing tools that make your videos look really cool, but are really easy to make. So things that you might have been able to do, you know, 5 years ago only with like a very sophisticated video editing tools or software, you know, you can just do right there in the app. Things like, you know, the filters and the different effects, like it can make you look like a mirror effect or, you know, things like that, that, you know, people have fun with.
Okay, let's assume I'm passive and I decide to become active. What are the steps in creating and posting a video?
So you basically hit this plus button and you shoot a video, and you could make a basic one where you're just literally, you know, shooting a video of, you know, yourself talking about the weather or whatnot. But what most people do is they'll usually choose a sound to go along with it, which is like a 15, 30, 60 second clip of a song. They might make a dance up to that song, like very tailored to that song. They might go on and see other trends, like and copy those trends, but like put their own spin on it. So if there's a dance trend going on or a prank or a joke or something like that, they would do that with their own spin. For example, there was a trend a while back that was popular about these gummy bears singing to the Adele song. And so people would like take out all these gummy bears, put the song and make it shoot the video as if like the gummy bears were singing the Adele song. And then people would just like do that in all sorts of different ways. When you follow a trick like that or a trend like that, they tend to get picked up a lot and get more popular and more viral because the company is usually putting some of that marketing muscle behind those trends.
Okay. Does everybody make the video right in the app, or do some people with better tools make it on the computer and then upload it to the app?
Some people do that. I think that's a lot more on YouTube, people will do that. On TikTok, a lot of people do end up doing it within the app, but they might spend hours on a video. Even just to create like a 30-second video, they might spend hours trying to create something and then finally get it right or edit it or stitch it together the exact way that they want to do it. And so, you know, as a kid, you're kind of going through this and you're like, oh, that's so cool. You know, it's 30 seconds long. How long could it take to make? But like some of these really professional creators will spend, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours on just one video.
And is there any time limit?
So when they first started, there used to be like a 15-second time limit, and now they broadened that out. You can do a minute. For some big creators, they give more like time limits too. But the idea is like bite-sized bits of content. So you really want to do something short. Most videos are 30 seconds long.
So let's assume I make a video. How's anybody going to see it?
So you can put a whole bunch of fat hashtags on it if you want people to be able to search it. And if you are a popular creator, you will have followers the same way you would be anywhere else. But otherwise, it's this kind of black box of the algorithm. They're showing it to people that, you know, they think are going to want to see it. And so your hope is, if you're trying to get popular, is that, you know, it gets pushed out to a whole bunch of people, but you really don't know how it happens. For some of the creators that are starting out and they want to really make a career out of it, they'll jump on the trends that are already happening, like that gummy bear thing I told you about, because that way they know that they're going to get views. And the more that they kind of do that, the more views that they think they're going to get. And then once you have a popular video, the chances are that your next video becomes popular increases.
Okay, let's assume I make a shitty video. Is it possible that nobody sees it?
Yeah.
Okay, what if I want to juice it? Can I tell all my friends, hey, go watch my video, try to move it up the algorithm?
You can. You can do that. It just, there's not like a retweet button the same way there is on Twitter. So it would have to be like you reaching out to your friends, being like, okay, go to my TikTok account and click on that video. It's a lot harder to share that way. And it puts a lot more of the kind of responsibility into the company's hands to know like what's going to go viral and what's not.
Okay. Well, in all these other platforms, these music platforms, there are all these people trying to manipulate them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can you manipulate TikTok?
Can you manipulate TikTok? I'm sure you can. I mean, people try it all the time. There are all these groups of TikTok creators that they have like their side groups, their side chats, where they have like these texts being like, oh, you know, like this trend is trending. We should jump on it now. The company also sends out, you know, emails to the top creators, or even, you know, not even the top creators, like thousands of popular creators saying like, hey, these things are trending. You should jump on these trends. So it's all kind of directed by the company. And if you follow the way that, if you kind of follow what the company wants you to do, the more views that you get, kind of as like a regular user type of thing. I mean, some kids, they treat it just like they do with Facebook, right? They're like a 12-year-old, 15-year-old, and they just want to make videos for their friends and themselves to see it. There's a lot of people who just do that as well.
Do we know how many people are active as opposed to passive?
So the numbers haven't been that great in the U.S. in the sense of clarity, because they are a private company. So we don't actually know. We mostly know downloads. And so we know it's been downloaded about 2 billion times globally, but about 200 million or so in the U.S.
Okay, let's assume I'm at home. I'm a total nobody. I make a video to a song that's come out within the last 12 months, and people love my video. What's going to happen next?
Yeah, so if people are spending time on it, if they're watching it, if they're watching it over and over again, it might be picked up in what's called the For You page, which is the page that you see when you open up the app, in lots of people's For You pages. And so, you know, it's in TikTok's best interest to get people. TikTok has two goals. One is to have people spend as much time on the app as possible. And to, once they have people spending as much time on the app as popular as possible, to sell advertising against that. So the more time you spend on the app, the better. So the more TikTok can show you things that will keep you on the app, the better. So if you have a video that tends to be that people like, they're going to want to push it out to as many people as possible. And so that's kind of where you see these viral posts going out. So, for example, I spoke to one of these creators, a dancer in Houston, Texas, and she made this video to the Megan Thee Stallion dance and Savage. And this actually wasn't a paid promotion. She just made it and she loved it. And she you know, had a lot of followers, but she wasn't like a famous star or anything like that. But it was a fun dance. People loved Savage. People loved the song. It was super catchy. And then, you know, people started making the dance. And then some of the really popular creators started making the dance. And once that happened, it just took off. And so then it became in TikTok's best interest to promote that dance, because what it was doing was promoting engagement. And it was promoting engagement with a song that they had happened to have, you know, a partnership with, that they had, you know, spent marketing dollars with the app to help promote. And so, you know, TikTok is scouring those things. They're looking for things that are taking off, and they can spot it early on, the rate of velocity of something taking off, and then just blow it up in a way that, you know, Twitter and Facebook just don't tend to do.
Okay, first, you talked about followers. I can actually follow a creator?
You can.
And then I will see all their new work?
Yes. I mean, you can go actually to their page if you want to just see their work. And then if you follow them, their stuff will come up in your feed. But it's not relegated to just your followers.
Okay. So let's assume I'm that woman in Houston. Let's just assume, for the sake of discussion, 100 million people watch my clip. On YouTube, literally that's monetized and I get a check. What happens on TikTok?
Right. So right now, they don't have that ability. I wouldn't put it past them for it to happen in the future. It sounds like it's something that's on the horizon and could probably happen very quickly. But what does happen is that you get deals. You get deals with advertisers. You get deals with record labels. You get featured in all sorts of, you know, different kind of spotlights. And TikTok has kind of created this business where they're connecting creators to these brands. And so the brands, you know, they want some creator to make it seem like they're authentically loving their like microwave oven pasta. This is a real story. So they like find five creators to like make a dance around microwaving their pasta. And it works, you know, because people see it and they're like, oh, that's cool. Or this energy drink is like, energy drinks have been all over TikTok, and you don't realize it's an ad. It's just like some person you like who's, you know, constantly drinking this energy drink in their videos, but they're getting paid for it. So it's not directly monetizable right now the way it is with YouTube. But these people are making, they're making money. I mean, they're making, you know, sometimes, you know, millions of dollars a year.
Okay. So you talked earlier about authenticity. If these people are aligning themselves with brands, doesn't that undercut authenticity?
Yeah. So this is what my biggest takeaway from this whole foundering podcast is that TikTok accomplished this remarkable marketing feat, making everybody think that this is this fun, authentic, totally spontaneous place to be. And then behind the scenes, making it as inauthentic as possible. And so the bigger they get, the less and less and less and less everything really is authentic. The popularity, the trends, all of that. The more you dig into it, the more you ask questions, the more you realize so much of it is staged and so much of it comes from, you know, TikTok's headquarters in Los Angeles and in China.
Okay, so but the lack of authenticity is not causing people to disconnect.
Not yet. You know, you do talk to people who are saying, "Oh, well, you know, like I'm not into it anymore." You know, some of the older teens I spoke to were saying, "You know, it's just not really for me anymore." So you are seeing some of that, but right now, I mean, their growth is they were the most popular app last year, you know, like the growth has not subsided.
Okay. Is there a place on the app I can go to see the top 10 or so, so that there is a sense of community amongst TikTok participants?
So you can go to this tab called Discover, but it's not necessarily they say it's all trending, but it's not really based on what's the most popular. It's based on what the company wants you to see or what advertisements, advertising deals that they have. So it's not really, there's no way to tell. Like today, if I open the app, there's no way I could personally tell what's the most popular video on TikTok today. There's just no way you would be able to do that.
Okay. Trump had a speech approximately a year ago in Oklahoma, and TikTokers gathered together to try to get tickets, such to the point it looked like the event was sold out when it was not. How did they do that?
So what they started doing was putting on, one of the really popular TikTok stars, had these ideas, you know, Trump is putting out this rally, let's all buy tickets and not show up. And then they started organizing through TikTok, but also off of TikTok, on Twitter, through chat groups, all sorts of different places around the internet, saying, like, everybody go do this, sending emails to their friends, you know, word of mouth. You know, it became not just a TikTok thing, but, you know, people were really, you know, activating all over the place. But a bunch of really popular TikTok stars jumped on this. They made all sorts of funny videos about how to do it and what to do and when they did it and, you know, kind of joking at Trump's expense. And so it just started showing up to more and more people, because the more people were engaging with it, the more the algorithm pushed it out to people. So, you know, some of it is definitely still spontaneous. You know, it's not like TikTok, as far as we know, you know, did that on purpose. But when something starts to gain traction, what TikTok can do then, and what TikTok's algorithm is set to do, is to just really push it and pull those levers and make it even bigger than it already is.
Okay, let's assume, like this girl in Houston, I make a video and it starts to become successful. At what time, and will I at all, hear from the brass at TikTok?
So pretty early on. It's not scientific. You know, there's been stories that we've heard from this rapper, for example, that we talked to in the podcast, Flo Milli. You know, she was this teenager from Mobile, Alabama. Nobody really heard about her. She was just making tracks on her own, posting them up on SoundCloud, you know, on the internet. And then someone started using it on TikTok and it blew up, and she didn't even have a TikTok account. But because it was so popular, TikTok's head of music partnerships called her up, flew her out to LA, had her in the office, set up a TikTok account for her, you know, really encouraged her to get on the app. And she did. And she did a really good, you know, she really amassed a lot of followers, and she signed up with a record label. And, you know, now she was nominated for BET Best New Artist. And, you know, and it's funny because in the podcast, Flo Milli says, you know, I didn't set out to be a TikTok star, but it just happened and I'm going to take advantage of it. And that's what TikTok bets on, right? That if everyone along the food chain makes money, everybody's happy, right? So if the record label makes money, if the artist makes money, if TikTok makes money and the advertising makes money, everybody's happy.
Let's assume I don't want to be a musician. For whatever reason, I create great dances, great clips. At what point will I hear from TikTok?
So the dances have been interesting. Talking to some of these professional dancers on TikTok, I was really fascinated by, because what they end up doing is the record labels have figured this out. This started kind of organically, where the record labels were seeing these dancers, you know, make up dances to their music, and they would help take off on TikTok, because once you had something to do with the music, you know, some sort of interaction, it became like a stickier song. And then the record labels caught on and they were like, oh shoot, well, we can actually just like pay these creators to do it. We don't have to wait for someone to create like a good dance. And so a lot of them started paying these creators to create these dances, and then TikTok would catch on to that, and they would, you know, promote, they would do some deal with a record label company and then push those videos out to more people. And so a lot of these people who make up dances on TikTok started becoming popular creators in themselves, because they would get more followers and be pushed out, you know, across the app and become famous in their own right.
Okay, let's stop and start with the music business. To what degree are the music labels and individuals interacting with TikTok or individual TikTokers to try to boost their music?
So every music label now has a group of people who are glued to TikTok, who are, you know, whose life is to learn TikTok, to know TikTok, to talk to them. TikTok is starting to do more and more live music, which they started during the pandemic, or a little bit before, but really picked up during the pandemic. And, you know, that I foresee being an even bigger thing. And TikTok not only helps these labels, but also helps connect them with the creators who, you know, kind of make the dances and things like that to help promote the songs as well.
Okay, the way business works, and it's not only the music business, if I'm a large corporation and there are three of them in the music business today, A, I put out a steady stream of product. B, that influences my relationship with, in this case, TikTok. And C, there can be a exchange of money. What's the landscape in this area?
So on what I will put aside, you know, there are deals with a record companies, you know, to use their music library and all of that. And that's a completely kind of different business transaction.
Yeah, that's, you know, if you use it, you get paid. But we're talking about starting the fire or promotion.
Right, exactly. So a lot of these artists, you know, TikTok doesn't necessarily pay these artists to be on TikTok. What they'll do is they'll connect
Let's stop. Let's stop for a second. Let's not even get that far. Let's assume I am at one of the three major labels. I have a song by an artist who is not even on TikTok. But I believe that if TikTokers made videos, it would start the fire on this song.
Got it.
A, what do I do first? Do I contact individual TikTokers? Do I contact TikTok the company? And do I pay TikTok any money? Is there any way I can make money other than the usage? And see, since I'm such a big company, do I edge out the smaller players?
Got it. So I think you'd probably take a two-prong approach. First, you would deal with a company and you'd deal with them, their music and the music marketing company. You could pay, you know, ad dollars to, you know, get that sound up in the sound library. You know, you can take out like what's kind of the equivalent of banner ads, basically, but for an individual sound that pops up and says, hey, consider using this sound with your video. So you could literally transactionally pay TikTok to do
that. Okay, hey, so let's stop there for a second. You have any idea what that might cost and how many people do it? Would I go on that page now and see 10 people offering to they say use my music? One, none?
I don't know how much it costs at this point. I do know that it can be substantial, but I don't know how much it costs. In terms of the sounds that show up, you know, I will check right now while we talk and see how many that they're offering. Okay. So in terms of like what I'm seeing when I'm about to make a video and to make a sound, so you pull it up and there is a kind of a banner ad at the top, and those are kind of sponsored sounds. So, you know, right now I'm seeing like guest playlists. I'm seeing different artists that are being, you know, showcased. There's a kind of a list of different playlists that TikTok makes. They get like famous people to make playlists. There's like trending feature sounds. You know, there's dozens of sounds up here that are being suggested to you from TikTok to be able to use. And then you know, there's depending on like what, let's say you want to make a country song, you're looking for a country song, so then you pick country and up pops, you know, hundreds of different sounds that you can kind of go through. And people who are into this, they'll spend hours looking through these sounds and listening to them and stuff like that. But if you're a casual TikTok user, you want to put a sound on your video real quick, you're going to click on the first thing that you see. And often that spot, you know, is paid for by the, you know, I would say 100% of the time that spot is paid for by a record label.
Okay, let's assume I'm on the very first page. Do I have to go to the next level to get a list, or do I see the ads and the playlist and also they'll give me like 10 songs? These are the trending songs.
Yeah, so there's a little thing that says like recommended, and it's kind of some of the trending songs out there. But when we say trending, it's like trending for you. So it's trending, but they think that you're going to like. So it's kind of like, it's not like a Billboard Top 100 type of thing. It's like a mix between what's popular, but also what they think you're going to want based on the previous videos that you've made before.
Can I pay to be in that trending list?
Yeah, you can. Yes, as far as I understand, yeah.
Okay, so let's assume I'm a big deep pocket. I come with an act. I go to the people and I say, hey, listen, I want to jam this. I say, okay, buy a banner ad, pay to be on the list, then what?
So TikTok will push back. So during the podcast, during the Foundering podcast, we talk about this experience with Megan Thee Stallion, where Megan's label said, you know, we want Captain Hook to be, you know, our focus track. And the TikTok's head of music partnerships told me that what she said back to them was, no, no, you might think that it's Captain Hook, but we want to see what the users think first. And so what she said was, okay, don't just put all your money behind Captain Hook. Put out 5 songs on the app and then let's let it simmer and see what people make. And then they kind of dipped into the private sound libraries of everybody, of all their users. And they started seeing that actually, no, out of those 5 songs, like it wasn't Captain Hook that got the early traction. It was Savage that people were into. And so they saw that and they said, okay, this is an indicator that, you know, Savage is really better suited to TikTok because of the music, the way it is, and because of this dance that was also trending. And so it was then that they waited, you know, a number of days that then they put up the banner ad, and then they started, you know, using all that money to for the promotion. And so it's not just record labels saying, hey, TikTok, here's money. Let me tell you what to do. It's oftentimes TikTok saying, hey, record label, let me tell you what to do based on what I'm seeing and what's going to be the most popular. Because it's not going to take off if people don't want to play with it. You know, the same way, you know, on radio, you're stuck, right? You can't go anywhere. You're in your car, you're listening to radio. The song is on, you hear it 10 times, you know, maybe after the 10th, 11th time you hear it, it becomes popular. You don't have a choice. Yeah, you could change the station, but your choices are limited, right? And with TikTok is like, okay, well, we want to see what people are already doing and then just like, you know, put that on steroids versus telling them exactly what to do.
Okay. But you say when they seeded five songs, if I heard you correctly, they know within a matter of days what the successful song is?
I mean, they know in a matter of hours. They could see it immediately, probably. But what they did was they did wait a number of days to see. Because what the sounds folder is someone saving a sound to make a video in the future. That could be tomorrow. That could be a week from now. They don't know that. But what they do know is someone cared enough about the song or liked it enough to be like, hey, I like that. I'm going to save that. And so it's such a powerful indicator that it's like, you can't even describe it because it's like literally the way people think. You know, people are thinking, okay, I like this song, so I'm going to save it. And so TikTok can see that in a way the record labels can't see that. And so then they know, okay, this is probably going to be popular because in a matter of days, it's a leading indicator, in a matter of days, there's going to be a ton of videos using this song. And then that's going to become viral.
Okay. Let's assume I'm a deep pocket. I have $1 million. I have an act lives in next door to me. Can I get access to the music department at TikTok?
Well, I think a lot of this is relationships. So all the big record labels have these relationships with TikTok. And so, you know, chances are, if you are one of the big record labels, you already have that relationship with TikTok and you're in constant contact with them.
So what are the odds if I'm an independent? Do I have any chance at all?
Oh, I see what you're saying. I think you have a chance. I think it's in TikTok's best interest to build out these music capabilities, particularly in different niches. So, you know, they've got the popular songs covered. They've got your Billboard 100. What they're focusing even more now on is, you know, what country music are we building out? What Latino music are we building out? Like what, you know, these kind of very specific kinds of music, because remember, what you see is different from what everybody else sees on TikTok. So they have to build out something really good for each very particular group of people. And so it's not enough to just have one thing that's popular for everyone. They also need to build out all these other things. So if you're an independent label that's maybe a little bit off the beaten path or has a niche or something like that, then I think you'd have an even better chance at succeeding because they are actually looking for that kind of thing.
Okay. The very first relationship, do I have to pay TikTok to talk to them?
That I don't know the answer to. I mean, I really don't, because I think that TikTok would say, you know, they're constantly scouring for new and interesting and cool things. But if you're an executive at TikTok, I've got to imagine that you're busy and there's only so many meetings that you can take each day. You know, the way around that, and you kind of alluded to this, is, okay, let me find a popular creator, pay them $50,000 to make a dance with my music. That can maybe have like a quicker, bigger bang for your buck. And if that song and that video does really well, then TikTok will notice you.
We have any idea how many views of a video one of those big creators gets?
Oh, can be, you know, tens of millions. I mean, Charli D'Amelio is one of the most popular people on TikTok, and she has over 100 million followers. So just let's assume every one of her followers sees it. That's just 100 million. And that's not even the people that don't follow her, you know? So, and then the thing about TikTok is that, like, once it gets really popular on TikTok, it spills into everyday life. And so you're starting to see those things in, there's a ripple effect into Twitter, Facebook. You know, you'll see it on the Jimmy Fallon show. You'll see it, you know, on your local news station. You know, it starts to become like a larger than life type of situation.
Okay, let's assume I do want to pay one of these creators. You're throwing out the figure of $50,000. Is that what it costs?
It depends. I mean, I've spoken to some creators who got paid $5,000. I've spoken to some creators who've gotten paid $100,000. There have been instances where someone's gotten paid $1 million for one post. So it just really depends the level of creator that you're going after.
Let's assume I do that. When you're saying, let's just use $100K for an example, is it $100K for one video, or do I have to have a campaign make multiple videos?
It just depends how you structure it. So some of these people could do $100K for one very unique video. Most of them will do like three or four, because the first one might not be better, might not take off. They might like test three or four of them and see which one. The woman who created the Savage Dance, which she was not paid for, but she has, this is a woman who does get paid for her dances, but the Savage one in particular, she did not get paid for. She made about five different dances to Savage until one of them took off. And so you're kind of playing with it to see, you know, what hits.
So if I have a successful track, I can only watch the video. I cannot listen to the complete song unless I go to another platform, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Let's say I am nobody from nowhere, and I realize it's a fast-moving landscape, but the classic example here is Lil Nas X with Old Town Road. Mm-hmm. Can you explain how something like that becomes successful?
Yeah, so Lil Nas X is kind of like this, like the early story that kind of woke the record industry up to all of this. He spent, I think it was like 20 or 19 weeks at the top of the Billboard Hot 100 chart, I think. Like, it was, I love this story because it kind of came out of nowhere. But, you know, what it opened people up to the possibility was, is like what he could do with it. And so then they realized, okay, well, you could like actually, you know, pay someone, you know, he could actually like pay someone for it, to do what he kind of started to do, naturally, you know. But he, you know, he like promoted himself. He created memes to promote Old Town Road. You know, he like would go on Twitter to talk about it. He made these different challenges. You know, like he really gamed it. He really tried hard, you know, to do that. And so what the record companies realized was like, oh, I could just do that. I could build a whole campaign around, you know, doing kind of like what he did and building off of his creativity there.
Okay. We live in a Tower of Babel society. Let's assume I create a smash in my bedroom and I don't gamify it. I don't basically say, you know, compete here. I don't blast people or watch my video. Is there any chance my video can make it?
Yeah, there's definitely still serendipity that happens on TikTok. I don't think you can say everything is rigged. I think there's definitely still, you know, fun stuff that happens, and it's different and unique and it's fun, and, you know, people jump to it and it suddenly gets popular. The thing about the TikTok algorithm is that it can recognize that very quickly early on. And so what that does is it rewards that engagement. And so there's definitely, if you're a songwriter, you know, I think that hope is definitely out there. It just gets harder the bigger it gets, and the more money that gets involved, the harder it gets.
Okay. So if I'm in a Lil Nas X a couple of years ago, but I am an artist and I'm starting to get traction. I kind of ask this, but let's, you know, at what point will I hear from somebody at TikTok saying, hey, you know, we want to be involved with you?
Pretty early on. I mean, they have relationships with so many people, and this is their job. I mean, music is so important to TikTok because it keeps people on the platforms. It keeps people coming to the platforms. It keeps them new and interesting and different. And so it's in TikTok's best interest to, you know, continuously bring new and different and interesting people onto the app. And so there are, you know, the woman we interview in our podcast, Isabel Quinteros Anus, her whole job, head of music partnerships, is to constantly be out there meeting with people, talking to them. And yes, she has these relationships with these big record labels, but she's also reaching out, you know, to the Flo Millies of the world who didn't have those, you know, record label contacts yet. And because she wants, they want to know these people first. It's in their best interest to, you know, find them first. And I think she told me that in the last year they had partnered up with musicians, I think like 50 musicians before they had gotten signed by record labels.
Do you have any idea how many people are working in that department?
I don't. I mean, in the US, it's not that big of a company. Like it's, you know, 1,000 people or so. It's not this huge, massive behemoth. I mean, in China, you know, I think they're up to like 60,000-70,000 people at ByteDance. And so, you know, but here in the US, it's not that many people.
Okay. How many countries is TikTok in?
Like every country, like 100 markets or something like that.
Okay. Now, this is something we've gotten from the internet. It, you know, it's a big world out there. So if I have success in America, okay, even if the song is in English, what are the chances it'll be pushed in foreign countries?
High. So all of these videos are pushed around or global. I mean, there's a separation between China and the rest of the world. So I would, you know, caution that what you're seeing in China is not what you're seeing in the rest of the world, but China excluded, it's all over, it's global.
Okay, you also said that TikTok will reach out to creators, talk to their parents, pay them, give them hints. Can you amplify that or see if I even have it correct?
Yeah, so we talked to a number of creators that were assigned these kind of like individual agents, these TikTok, you know, managers. And these people can do all sorts of things from, hey, my video was blocked. Can you figure out how, you know, tech support issues? Can you figure out why that happened or why I'm offline and why I can't get on, something like that. They also send out these emails that are saying like, okay, this trend is trending. We just introduced this feature. Everybody use that. If you use it, it's going to trend and your video is going to get more people. Same with hashtags and then what they call challenges, which is this idea of like, you know, there's like a dance challenge or like a, you know, remember the like water, what was it, yeah, like the water bucket challenge a million years ago? Like that's something, yeah, that would have been on TikTok, you know, like this challenge. And so what creators realized was if they listen to the managers, if they watch what's happening in these emails and they do what they're asked to do, that their stuff does get more viewership, you know, because TikTok will sign some sort of, a lot of these challenges are sponsored by brands that are, you know, brands are paying TikTok for this and they're being guaranteed a certain number of views. So then TikTok will go and push those videos out to more people. And the creators that follow those challenges will get their videos seen by more people. They'll up their follower counts. They'll get more money in the end. And it's all kind of a flywheel from there.
Okay. Are there any individual ads or all ads are embedded in the videos?
There are also now, like, you'll be scrolling and it's like a takeover. So yeah, those are ads that are there already, and they're coming more and more. And the other interesting thing that they're testing out is now e-commerce, where you can literally buy something within somebody's video. Like you click on that link to buy that item that creator is talking about at the moment.
Okay, if they send one of these emails, like manager emails, how many people are getting them?
You know, that I haven't been able to get down to the bottom of, but I have spoken to dozens of creators, and every creator I've spoken to is getting these emails. So I don't know what the threshold is. You know, if I were to guess, I would say something like 50,000 followers or something like that. But every creator that I've spoken to with more than 50, 100,000 people are getting, have been getting these emails.
Let's assume I'm on the list. How often will I get an email?
It was like once a week or so for a number of times. I got on the email list somehow, and I was getting them once a week or so. I think it's less frequent now.
Okay. So does TikTok today, or did they ever literally pay direct cash to creators?
In China, they paid direct cash to creators, and that was, and they also paid people to come on, and you know, from other platforms. When TikTok launched in the U.S., the global version, the ex-China TikTok, they also paid some creators to make videos. These days, it is more of a hey, let me set you up with this brand, and they do matchmaker, and you know, they take a cut sometimes, and sometimes they don't.
Okay, let's assume I'm successful on TikTok, and TikTok knows who I am. I'm literally going to get an email from them. Hey, we think, or they're going to contact me. However, that you know, this brand is interested. You should work with them, or am I going to have to get a manager who's going to work the relationship? How does it work?
So both ways. So if you have a manager, they'll talk to your manager. If it's just you, they'll talk to you. And yeah, you'll get contacted by them and be like, hey, we identified you, or this brand is interested in working with you. Or they'll send brands like a dossier of like 15 people being like, hey, these people would fit with your brand. You know, you should reach out to them. We'll give you connect, or, you know, we'll connect you with them.
Let's assume I've had some success and I say, this is what I want to do for my occupation. How do I make sure, other than doing great content, how do I make sure that opportunities come my way?
Most of the people that we speak to for the podcast, for the Foundering podcast, had agents. You know, they started out without one, and then at a certain level, they ended up getting a manager or getting an agent. And a lot of the things they do is those brand partnerships. But oftentimes, you know, like the brands will just message them, or, you know, sometimes they start off with free stuff. Hey, I'll give you this free sweatshirt if you wear it in your video, or like these unboxing videos where they're like, you can keep the stuff we send you. As long as you make a video about it. So that's kind of like the gateway drug of this marketing, is like people will start that way with like free merchandise. And then they kind of build up from there.
And this can be done without any involvement from the TikTok organization.
Correct.
Okay. How many people are making in excess of 50,000 US on TikTok?
Oh gosh. I mean, alone for the Foundering podcast, we spoke to dozens. So, you know, there's definitely, you know, people who are making a lot of money. I don't have a number for you, though.
Okay. How many people are making seven figures?
I think, you know, Forbes did this piece that were like the richest TikTok stars, like their seven highest earning TikTok stars. I remember they did this, I think, yeah, last summer. And so they had, you know, this woman, Addison Rae, $5 million, Charli D'Amelio, you know, $2 million a year. Her sister, Dixie D'Amelio, $3 million a year. You know, these are people who are probably now making double that given the popularity now.
Okay. That's a lot of money. Let's assume they pay me a million. I'm making $1 million a year. Huh? Forget taxes. How much of that is net to me?
Their estimation was this pre-tax earnings. You know, if they don't take some of that out, I'm assuming some of that goes to their managers.
Well, that's
I'm
my question.
Sure.
You know, if you're a successful musical artist, you have the manager, you have the lawyer, the accountant, you have the agent. And they're chipping away at the gross, and many of them take off the top. So in this particular case, if I get $1 million, let's assume I got to pay an agent. Am I going to have to pay anybody else?
I spoke to one TikTok star who told me that he, you know, he makes seven figures on TikTok and that he was mostly doing it himself, that he had hired an assistant, some young kid out of college. And, you know, he had a manager. But when I asked him, you know, how much are you making personally? You know, he said seven figures. So I'd imagine it was still, you know, his manager and agent is also making enough that it's worth it to them, you know, to continue doing that. But a lot of these managers, you know, they're managing dozens of people at a time. They have these kind of big houses of folks, you know, so I'm sure that that all adds up.
Okay. You have any idea what percentage the manager takes?
I don't. It's a good question, though.
Okay. So let's talk about these houses. Give us the history and the status of these houses.
Oh, the hype houses? So they're called hype houses or TikTok mansions. And, you know, I think this started back in the Vine days. I don't know if you remember Vine, but...
I certainly remember, but okay.
Yeah, like they would call it... They all lived... There was like one house on Vine Street that they found in LA. And it was like this collaboration houses where they would all make videos together. And what these folks realized was that, you know, the more they make videos together, the more they can boost their view counts and the more followers they get, because people are like suddenly invested in the drama. And so it's this like real world, you know, meets Shark Tank kind of experience where it's like 10 kids living in a flashy house in Los Angeles, making, you know, doing brand deals. And with for brands, it's great, right? You make one deal with a house and you're suddenly in 10 popular kids' videos. You know, it's a much more efficient way of doing some of these deals. And then like their followers get invested in the drama. And then you have like the Hollywood Reporter and other like, you know, LA magazines and stuff following them around and stuff like that. And so it starts to drum up even more business and even more followers for them.
How many of these houses are there?
There's definitely, I mean, I can count on my, like, top of my head, maybe, you know, a dozen or so. But, you know, I'm sure there's a lot more smaller collaboratives of people who are, like, trying to break into it.
Okay, let's talk about a house. You know, especially some of these are in ritzy neighborhoods and they're large. Who gets the house started? You know, they have, maybe 10 or 20K a month to rent the house.
Yeah. So the person we spoke to, Alex Warren, who lives in what was originally called the Hype House, he was the one who started the house with his friends and kind of recruited people. I don't remember if... I don't know who ended up footing the bill, the original rent for all of this. But, you know, it's this like 10 bedroom. They have a pool. They have like a pool table and a movie theater and a game room and, you know, a million bedrooms. And then they all kind of like live together and they order takeout all the time and things like that. There have been stories and some, you know, cautionary tales around managers who end up putting the down payment, you know, like the rental, like what's it called when it's a down payment for a rental?
It's a mortgage or it's a rental, it's a lease.
Well, yeah, like the first like 2 months, putting up front like the first 2 months or something. And then like they're not making as much money as they wanted to. And then the manager is stuck with like all these kids who, you know, so there's been some cautionary tales around some of the managers who have taken a chance to kind of try to start their own and then having it, you know, go into utter failure.
Well, there was a recent story. I think it was one of the Paul brothers. I'm not absolutely sure. And they said he had the house and he was giving a certain percentage to the other people in the house and taking the lion's share or a great deal for himself. Is that sometimes the case?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that expensive. I mean, to rent some of these houses. I mean, the Hype House, I remember, I think it was like a $9 million house, but you're renting it. So you're not you know, you're paying maybe $20,000, $30,000, something like that, maybe even less, you know, for these things. And you're dividing it up between 10. Some of them are stuffing like 15 people into it. And so, you know, you could take a cut that way. You know, every month you could take a cut that way.
Okay, but let's just say I'm a guy in Kansas. I'm making $100K a year. I move into the Hype House. Am I already going to have to give a percentage of that to the Hype manager for living in the Hype House?
Yeah, I think you have to pay rent, you know, for example. And, you know, some of the houses, though, they've gotten sponsorships. So, like, they'll get an energy drink to, like, sponsor the house. And then you could, that's your payment, right? That they're paying the monthly rent for the house.
Okay. If you are a successful creator, how often do you have to post a video?
Constantly. So we did this event with one of the people, Karen Spencer, who we interviewed on our podcast, who's a manager and who's been in digital and social media for a long time. And, you know, she says that, you know, you're incentivized to post often. When you drop off, your fans drop off, and TikTok, you know, shows you no love when you don't show them love. And so, you know, it goes back to the original goal of TikTok, which is to keep people on as long as possible. If there's not enough content, they're not keeping people on. And if there's not enough content from the popular people, you're not keeping these eyeballs. And so, you know, you don't realize how much time it takes to make these videos. And so, you know, you might look like you're spending the day lounging around in the pool and it looks super, you know, glamorous, but you're really spending many, many hours a day to make many videos a day to be able to keep people interested.
And what about, would you say one video a day, one video a week?
Multiple videos a day.
Multiple videos a day.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about the issue of bad actors on the, whether it be young people on the format, people getting information they shouldn't have, trolling these people, privacy, what's going on there?
Yeah, so we devoted all of episode 4 of the Foundering podcast to this issue of the young kids that are on the app. And so I think, you know, the takeaway is bad stuff happens on all social media apps. The difference is two. One is some of these kids are really, really young. They're 8 years old. They're 9 years old. They're in elementary school and they're seeing some really, really mature things. The second thing is that it's so difficult to see what's going on. A parent has a really difficult time monitoring and seeing, unless you're literally physically sitting next to your child, it is hard to see what they're looking at. And you can set all sorts of different things. You know, you could set words to filter out. You could set time limits on them. You can set all different things. But at the end of the day, unless you're physically sitting next to them, you don't know exactly, you know, what they're looking at. And so, you know, we tell this story where we talk to a woman, who told us her story about an 8-year-old family member who, you know, started using TikTok and, you know, started getting comments from older men, or what they thought were older men, telling him what to do, what kind of videos to make. And he made a video of himself in his underwear because he was told to make a video of himself in his underwear dancing around to it, posted it on his feed. His feed got, you know, 20 hits or something, 20 views, nothing. But then one of these men downloaded his video and then reposted it up on their TikTok account. And then it got thousands. And suddenly this 8-year-old is in his underwear and that's on the internet forever. And you never know what these people are going to do with that. You never know, like, what some of these people are doing, how they might find him, how they might use the app, you know. In recent years, like in January, a few months ago, TikTok made a number of changes to make this a safer place. But it's still, you know, you get exposure to things like anorexia, suicide, you know, anti-vax stuff, just all sorts of really mature content that you don't necessarily want, you know, an 8-year-old looking at.
Now, in the past year, the U.S. government, specifically under the former guy, wanted to shut Tic Tac down or sell it to an American company because of privacy data issues. What's the real story there?
So the most frustrating part about doing this Foundering podcast and spending so much time studying TikTok is that we still don't have the answer as to whether or not this app is a national security threat or not. And so that was kind of the whole thing, right, from Trump saying, we think that all this very personal data that powers your algorithms is, at the end of the day, owned by a Chinese company. And in China, there is a law that says, if the government asks for this data, you have to give it to me. Now, TikTok says all of our data is stored in the US and with backup servers in Singapore, and it's not stored in China, and TikTok itself is not available in China. And so therefore, we're not giving money away to the Chinese government. Now, if you take them at face value, it could be true. Right now, they could also not be giving data to the Chinese government. That doesn't mean they're not amassing a massive trove of really personal data, really, you know, kind of these personal profiles of tens of millions of Americans that could be used for nefarious purposes in the future, or that could be hacked, you know, by a government actor who might have keys to the castle. Like, you don't really know any of those things because it's impossible to prove a negative or something that will happen in the future. And so that, at the end of the day, is the crux of the issue, is that the facts are TikTok collects a lot of data that could eventually be dangerous in dangerous hands, and that they are owned by a Chinese company subject to Chinese laws. So those are facts. What you don't know is, has anything wrong been done? You don't, we don't know that. There's no publicly available data, and Trump never made the case, and publicly at least. And when he left office, everything was just a one big question mark, because the Biden administration came into power and basically put a hold on everything. And so this idea of banning the app or selling it to a U.S. company, or all the lawsuits that are currently held up in court, were frozen. And the Biden administration said, yes, we're going to look at this, but not right now, because we have COVID and the economy and other things that are pressing and that we're going to focus on right now.
Okay, you talk about the vaunted algorithm, which is obviously great for TikTok. Is there some special skill ByteDance has that their algorithms are better, or it's just good for their platform? Like, do they write better algorithms than Facebook and other platforms?
It's hard to really know the answer to that. You know, we speak to a lot of people who say the answer is flat out yes, that it's just much more sophisticated. The other answer that I get to that question is they have so many more years of data. If you remember, they started in 2012. ByteDance started in 2012. So here is 9 years of training your data on people and the way people think. And so it doesn't necessarily matter that that was in China. Like, they share a lot of that technology and the way that the algorithm works. And so you just have a more sophisticated way of analyzing a lot of this data that they've been able to amass over the years. What I know is that TikTok, to me, feels so much more addictive than Facebook or Instagram do, and so much more personalized. And so, you know, I'm not an expert. Like, how do you really know who has a better algorithm unless you're inside those companies and able to identify that? But it seems to be working for them, because more and more people are downloading it and staying on it.
Okay, if we move towards the future, I would call all of these social media platforms, i.e. the audience can move anywhere. And certainly since MySpace, which ultimately faded away, all of these things have continued to exist, but they are not the hot platform. Okay. What is going to happen to TikTok? I know you can't predict the future, but predict it.
Yeah. So in our last episode of the Foundering podcast, which isn't out yet, it will come out next week. But I'll give you a preview. you know, my bet is on this company getting bigger and better. And they are moving fast. They are hiring more people. They got Trump off their back for at least a year. You know, they have the U.S. government who has let them not paid attention to them for the last 6 months as they continue to grow. They had the pandemic help them get more people on there, and they are expanding. So right now they are expanding into e-commerce. Like, if you think about that opportunity, Facebook has totally failed in e-commerce. Instagram has not really realized its full potential. Same with Pinterest. Like, if they can crack e-commerce faster and better than everyone else, then it opens up a whole new avenue for them in a way that, you know, hasn't really been done before in the US, though is being done a lot of in China. So, you know, I think they go up from here. I don't think it's a fad. You know, we can do this again in 5 years and see if I'm right. But I do think that there's that if they continue on this trajectory of moving fast and constantly iterating new features for people, that that they'll just keep going with their success.
Now, it is a Chinese company, as you stated earlier. These are multifarious companies. They're giving your news, they're giving e-commerce, etc. Do you believe that model can be replicated in the US and possibly by ByteDance?
So I think the hardest thing to be replicated in the U.S. is the payment, because payments are so heavily protected in the U.S. compared to, you know, Walmart, for example, has been trying to get a payments license for decades and hasn't been able to do that. And so I think it would be so hard for a Chinese company to be able to take payments in the U.S. And without payments, I think it would be really hard to become as big as they are and ubiquitous as they are in China, because that's what kind of how they got it in China, is like they became the wallet. And so everything is purchased on there. And so you just started doing everything on those apps. Now, they could get around that. They could partner with someone. They could partner with like a PayPal or Amazon or someone like that. Like, you have no idea how they would do that. But I think that that would be one big roadblock for them.
Well, in America today, we go to multiple sites for our information, literally news and, you know, social, et cetera, et cetera. And whereas in China, to my understanding, is these platforms are a black hole that will cover all 360 degrees of life. Think ByteDance wants to do that? In America, do you think it's replicable?
I think that they would love to do that. But I think we're far off on that. And I think that there are big roadblocks in areas like, you know, like payments that they wouldn't necessarily be able to do in a way that they can in China. Like, in China, ByteDance has a payments license and that they got last year, I think. And they are doing that. And so you can starting to buy more things there. You're reading your news there. Like, more and more touch points are happening. In the US, I think it's just much harder. So I think for now they're going to stick with entertainment, but expand into e-commerce, probably education, probably language, like things like that, that are a little less sensitive, given that they are still a Chinese, at the end of the day, still owned by a Chinese company.
Okay. You said at the beginning, you told your editor years back, whoa, this TikTok is happening. You're not only covering TikTok. What else is happening right now that we should be aware of?
In tech or music or?
Well, anything, tech primarily, but you can put all these different elements together.
Let me think about that one. I mean, you brought up Clubhouse. I think Clubhouse is definitely interesting. You know, I am in the kind of anti-Clubhouse camp, I think. Like, I don't see the future as much as some of the people that I'm talking to.
You're preaching to the choir. My goal is to never talk on the phone. If the younger generation won't even have voicemail, who wants to sit there? You know, it was driven primarily by high profile people on an exclusive basis. And we've learned with clubs, if you can't get in, while that drives, it's not even on Android yet. And now everybody's trying to imitate it. I don't think it's ultimately a big company or feature, but listen, we have all the craziness with the Robinhood app, so you never know in reality. Anything else you can say that might be on the horizon?
Yeah, I mean, I do think this investing, speaking of investing, I mean, I don't think people are realizing this massive interest from Gen Z in investing and using TikTok and Facebook and Reddit. I mean, we saw with the power of Reddit and in the financial markets to rock GameStop and other stocks. There's a account on TikTok of like financial investing. And, you know, I've spoken to one creator who was saying like, yeah, I'm in the stock market now because I learned all about it on TikTok. And so you don't realize like how much social media is interacting with the financial markets and how much these young kids like Gen Z and younger are learning about the markets and investing real money. And they're learning all about it through these platforms. And I think that's kind of an overlooked area that people aren't quite realizing.
And that begs the question of NFTs. Any NFTs in the TikTok world? What do you think's happening there?
I'm sorry. Like, I don't get NFTs. I don't understand it. I feel like such an old person when people talk about NFTs. And I don't know. I don't get it. But I also, it's not my strong suit. Like, I'm not an expert at that kind of stuff. And like, but yeah, I am a complete neophyte when it comes to
NFTs. Well, my question is anybody on TikTok or ByteDance, are they monetizing via NFTs?
Oh, you know, I wouldn't put it past them. I'm not aware of anything that TikTok is doing with NFTs. I think I read there was one TikTok star that sold one video like as an NFT, but I don't think that TikTok itself like had a role in that. But yeah, I mean, I think that they're putting, you know, some of these creators themselves are seeing the value in selling an NFT of their videos. But I haven't seen TikTok itself do it.
Well, as Jimmy Kimmel told me, it's imaginary baseball cards. On that yeah, note, exactly. Shelley, I think we've covered the landscape. Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you so much. And your article, just like picking apart every little bit and relating it and putting it, you know, using your vast, you know, knowledge and experience of the record label industry and talking about, you know, just kind of picking apart one by one the article. I was just so floored away by your thoughtful response to it. So thank you so much for that.
Well, that's it. You know, they say in today, no one can be an expert on everything. Although to a great degree, the information is out there if you know where to look. In the old days, there were 100 records on the chart. Everybody who was in the business knew all 100 records. No, now records go number one. You've never heard of them. So I was so impressed with your article that it went into depth and certainly was never covered in the music press. So for those listening, we certainly have gotten the top line. If you want to go deeper, as Shelley says, you can go to the Foundering Podcast, easily searchable online, where they go further in depth. Once again, Shelley, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you.
Till next time, this is Bob Lefsetz.